这个方式恰恰还是跨越亲属关系，还有咱们先 illustrating 在这里面这里 the wound or identifying these material body, home, family, friends, and so on, and thus entangled in the cycle of birth and death, accepts phantasmagoria as reality. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, Shalakirtanadi Lakshana Nastratantola Yanyata.If one seriously desires to vanquish the duality of material illusion, one must adopt the process of chanting and hearing the glories of the Supreme Lord. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu also cited the five following Vedic reference. Hari Nam, Hari Nam, Hari Nam, Hari Kevanam, Hello, and the state of the Kali, and the Brihan, the Nadani, the Purana. According to Vedic literatures, the living entities of this Kali Yuga are very feeble in their power to understand spiritual knowledge. Mandaha samanta matayo manda bhagyati upadvittaha. Their minds are always disturbed and they are lazy and misguided by so many bogus leaders. They are further described in the Bhagavatam as nisattam, impatient and impious, duramedham, possessed of weak intelligence, and Parasita Yusaha, very short lived. Therefore, one who seriously wants to overcome the ignorance of material life must surrender to the process of chanting and hearing the holy name of the Lord. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. As well as reciting and rendering submissive oral receptions to the transcendental literatures presented by the Lord, such as Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, and Chaitanya Charitamrita. It should be understood that the living entity is completely spiritual and never actually becomes mixed with material energy. Asango Hyayam Purushaha. According to Srila Jiva Goswami, Tasmin Sudhe Vikalpa Yate, although the living entity is Sudha, pure spirit soul, he imagines that he is a material creation and thus entangles himself in a network of illusion called Dehapacha Kalachari. Srila Vaishnava Chakravarti Thakura has used the word mancha and pratyaksha to describe the experience of material life. Mancha pratyaksha means that which is experienced only within the mind. The actual pratyaksha is described in Bhagavad Gita 9.2. Rajavidya Rajavidyam Bhavatam Vidam Uttamam Pratyaksha Bhagavam Nanyam Sushupam Karatamavyam. When one solicitly hears the instructions given by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita, which constitute the king of all knowledge, Rajavidya, the most confidential of all information, Rajagulyan, by associating such spotless spiritual knowledge, Bhavatram and Amuttamam, one can directly experience one's eternal nature, Pratyaksha, Bhavam. By experiencing one's eternal nature, one becomes thoroughly religious, Dhanyam, blissful, Sushukam, and eternally engaged in devotional service of the Lord, Kavatam Abhyayam. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura has quoted the following Shruti mantra in this connection. Vijita Vishika Vyamputna Vyambu Adananda Nana Sushaikam. By the very senses and light air one has conquered, the uncurbed mind will again drag one away. According to Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura, the meaning of this verse is Samadaya Vidos Chalanam. If one rejects the lotus feet of one's spiritual master, all of one's previous spiritual advancement become null and void. This has already been indicated in the present verse by the words Guru, in the previous verse by the words Guru Devatatma. Unless one accepts the bona fide spiritual master in your beloved parampara as one's worshipful beauty and life and soul, there is no question of that becoming the duality of material life. Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakura has made the following comments on this verse. Control of the mind is a result of living a life of devotional service to the Lord. By the influence of fixed devotional service, the accepting and rejecting mind can stop its thirst for sensory enjoyment apart from Krishna. In transcendental Krishna consciousness, there is no contradiction, pettiness, or lack of ecstasy. In other words, it is not like a material object which always proves temporary and constantly miserable. Having forgotten Krishna, the conditioned living entity is suffering in the misdirection and perversion of his own so-called intelligence. The living entity's fragmented parts of the Supreme Self of Krishna, but have fallen from Krishna's kingdom of spiritual pastimes. Because of forgetting the Supreme Lord, they become prone to sinful life and turn their attention to dangerous material objects which fill them with constant fear. If one desires to subdue the mind which is constantly engaged in dwelling with mental compulsion, one must take to the devotional service of Lord Krishna. Is explaining the process of devotional service. This verse, in one sense, is a precursor to the following verse, which actually Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravarti before quotes in his Madhurya Karambini, but the next verse represents the platform of Shakti. So this verse and the next verse represent devotional service on that platform of Shakti, or devotional service where one is actually free from attachment to the material energy and attached to Krishna. And the following verse he uses to cite as an example of prema, Krishna prema. So here, these are actually the symptoms of the devotee who's perfected his sadhana. In other words, a shakti means that a devotee has practiced devotional service and has become perfect in the sadhana. And when they become perfect in the sadhana, these are the symptoms that you would expect to see on that devotee. If these symptoms are not there, then the devotee is still practicing but hasn't come to the perfection of sadhana. A shakti is the end of sadhana bhakti, and it is the crossroads where one is about to enter bhava bhakti. Not yet, but so the sadhana bhakti has been perfected and one is eligible to begin bhava bhakti. As Master Guru Shamasa said last time he was here, Swami said, bhava begins when there's no sex desire. So that's a, there's a lot of technical understanding, but if you really want to know, that's when bhava bhakti begins and sex life, sex desire finishes. As long as we have some agitation, then we know we're not quite there. But this platform here, the shakti, so of course, what are the stages that lead to this platform? First, there is a tiny little spark of faith that Krishna is God, and if I take up the process of devotional service, I will become perfect in every way. And there is nothing else for me to do except to take. So that is the beginning, that beginning faith. And even that, that little spark of faith, although it's the beginning of devotional service, one who has that shakti is more advanced than everyone else, whether they be karmis, yogis, jnanis, materialists, great philosophers, so-called, great charitable persons, or great persons with so-called, wonderful qualities. Actually, that person who has that spark of shakti faith, they are far, far greater than all those other persons who do not have even that little faith in Krishna. So from that Shraddha, of course, one associates with devotees, and that Shraddha, that faith in Krishna, becomes more firm. And then when that faith becomes firm, one has enough faith to make a very serious commitment to devotional service, to surrendering to Krishna, by accepting the disciplines of the spiritual master. The disciplines of the spiritual master, the disciplines of the Shastra, and begins to actually follow the different rules and regulations of devotional service. And by that discipline, then the unwanted things within the heart, namely the passion, the ignorance, which represent, of course, lust, greed, envy, those things start to diminish bit by bit. And then, as they diminish, that allows one to become steady, firmly fixed in devotional service, and nishtha. And when one becomes firmly fixed in devotional service, what that means is that they're predominantly on the spiritual platform. There's still some material influence, but predominantly they perform spiritual activities, and therefore predominantly they get a spiritual taste. Of course, if one is predominantly performing material activities, it's not really possible to get that, you know, real spiritual taste. So that is called ruchi. One has a very strong taste of performing devotional activities, which is stronger than one's desire for anything else. One can't say one has ruchi if one has a limited taste for devotional activities, that their taste in the non-devotional activities is far greater. Ruchi means that their taste for devotional service is far greater than anything else, and they're fully absorbed. From ruchi comes this platform of the shakti. So one is fixed up in devotional service, one has a very strong taste. So what would be the difference between the platform of ruchi and the shakti? They're actually very, very similar. What would be the predominant difference?
When we have strong asakti.
What's that?
When we have got strong asakti.
In ruchi there is also strong attachment, because one has a powerful taste, so there is also strong attachment. And of course in the shakti one also has a strong, it is certainly more mature, it is strong taste, and also there is a strong attachment. There's a slight difference.
What was that?
Rasa was saying the reciprocation is the difference.
It's to do with. See, Bhava Bhakti means pure devotee, basically. So Ashakti means not attached to material things. So there must be something that still bothers a person. There must be some...
Still pure devotee.
There must be some fraction or some affection for material things that still...
There's certainly the amount of the anarthas destroyed in the heart are not as complete as what they are in Bhagavad Gita today.
It will be described
in the Tadurika Dhamma. Yeah, on the platform of the Shakti, the anarthas from simple activity or even pious activity not related to devotional service, and from improperly performed devotional service, where you can come from that, they're absolutely destroyed
at
a shakti, yeah. But there's still the anarthas from Nanavarad is considered to be completely destroyed, almost complete, whereas at Bhava, yes, at Ruchi, that's right. And at Bhava, the Nama Parad is considered completely destroyed, that only prana is actually all nasties, including nama, parad, absolutely destroyed. So there's some distinction there. But the other thing that I was looking for is that we were discussing the other week, someone was saying that, quoting that we should be more attached to our service. We should be more attached to serving Krishna than the particular service, which is a fact. It's a fact. But in one sense, that's the difference between Ruchi and Ashakti, is that at Ruchi, the devotee is actually still at the point where they're absorbed in perfecting their service. And they get a great taste from that. They are very attached to the service and they're absorbed in perfecting and they get a very, very rich taste from that. The slight difference as a Ashakti is that the devotee, the object, transfers from the service to Krishna more fully. And therefore, the devotee is always absorbed in the transcendental qualities of Krishna himself and the wonderful reciprocation between Krishna and the devotee. Both Ruchi and Shakti have both qualities. There's just a slight emphasis. Shakti is more mature form of Ruchi, with a slight more emphasis on the Krishna as being the object of one's thoughts and meditations. In one sense, it's natural for those devotees leading up to Ruchi to be more absorbed in their service. Of course, there's absorption in Krishna, but there's a slight more emphasis on the service. At Ashakti, of course, which is a precursor to Bhava, assimilation and understanding of Krishna start to really manifest. That's one of the differences as well, is that up until that point, one's conception of Krishna is not as clear, which certainly doesn't help one to, as one's understanding of Krishna becomes very clear, then that precipitates a more profound meditation on Krishna himself and his qualities, which become more recognizable, understood at that. So this is the platform of devotional service that's described here. And Krishna also speaks about that, very similar, in many places in the Bhagavad Gita, but in the 14th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna begins to discuss this platform. 14th chapter, verse 19, he says, Nanya Gunabhya Kataram Yida Drastana Pasiti Gunabhyascha Paramdati Madhavam Sarodagati. When one properly sees that in all activities no other performer is at work than the modes of nature, and he knows the Supreme Lord, who is transcendental to all these modes, he attains my spiritual nature. I'll read the next verse. When the embodied being is able to transcend these three modes associated with the material body, he can become free from birth, death, old age, and the distresses, and can enjoy nectar even in this life. So then Arjuna asks, Arjuna Vacha Kelingas Kringanani Tam Pito Bhati Babo Kim Chara Katam Chaitam Chingunam Ati Bhavitate. Arjuna inquired, O my dear Lord, by which symptom is one known who is transcendental to these three modes? What is his behavior and how does he transcend the modes of nature? Because we discussed this in Bhakti Shastri, little to that. Previously, in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna asked a similar question in chapter 2, which was
Arjuna
asked Krishna in chapter 2, saying that what are the symptoms of one who is attaining this transcendental divine consciousness?
How does he sit?
How does he walk? Like this.
How does he talk?
How does he talk? Is the most important thing. So actually, in that Śrīla Viśvanātha Cakravarti Pakkura mentions that he didn't ask at that point how one transcends. So he asked the same question again later on in order to emphasize that point. So therefore, Krishna answers that in verses 22 to 26. And three questions there. I won't read the Sanskrit. In 22 to 25, he says, "The Supreme Personality of God has said, O son of Pandit, he who does not hate illumination, attachment and delusion when they are present, nor long for them when they disappear, who is unwavering and undisturbed through all these reactions of the material qualities, remaining neutral and transcendental, knowing that the modes alone are active, who is situated in the self and regards alike happiness and distress, who looks upon a lump of earth, a stone, and a piece of gold with an equal eye." Of course, some of those, you recognise that from the sixth chapter as well, right?
Fifth and sixth.
Yeah. "Who is equal toward the desirable and the undesirable, who is steady, situated equally well in praise and blame, honour and dishonour, who treats alike both friend and enemy, and who has renounced all material activities, such a person is said to have transcended the modes of material nature." So that verse actually describes the internal symptoms, which answers Arjuna's first question. The internal symptoms are that one is not attached, he's not hankering or lamenting for the effects of the modes when they're present or absent. Because that's hard to perceive from other people externally, it's an internal symptom. Whereas the other symptoms here are external, they're things that can be perceived by others, that someone who's not disturbed by ritualities and praise and blame, like that, those things can be perceived. How one actually transcends the modes of material nature, Krishna describes in text number 26. Mamcharyoga vicharanya charana bhakti yoga nishete sarvanam some teacher sam brahmaduyane kalpate. The one who engages in full devotional service, unfailing in all circumstances, at once transcends the modes of material nature and thus comes to the level of Brahman. Krishna describes that by engaging in devotional service that one actually transcends. In the first verse 19, Krishna said that one who can see only the modes of material nature are working and who knows Krishna. That verse and this verse have to go together. In other words, if one doesn't take up devotional service, one cannot actually manifest these transcendental symptoms and cannot remain aloof from those and cannot have that transcendental vision to perceive how the modes are operating in this material world. So there, these verses of Srimad Bhagavatam, further elaboration on the same principles which Krishna has described in the Bhagavad Gita. And Krishna describes here that when the conditioned soul dreams at night of something desirable or horrible, and when he daydreams of what he would like to have or avoid, he creates a reality that has no existence beyond his own imagination. So here, same information given in the Bhagavad Gita, but here the sage is giving an analogy to help us to fully understand the same information. And the analogy given here is that just as when we're dreaming, there are so many things that happen in the dream. We may Krishna had this repeated dream when I was young, that I used to go to school, and then, you know, I was about 7 or 8 years old, and when I got to school, I remembered that I forgot to put my clothes on. So I'd spend my whole dream hiding behind a tree, and somehow wonder how I was going to get home without anyone seeing me. You know? I'm such an idiot. How could you forget to wear clothes? You know? I used to have this dream, this recurring dream, you know? And I was standing for hours, just, you know, someone sees me, I'm dead, you know, like this. So, of course, in the dream, there's something very horrible, you know, something, you know, you'll be criticized and humiliated, and you're fearful and complete anxiety, you know, hiding, you know, like this. But, in actuality, it's not happening. It's a separate existence from reality, which has no real reality. That's not actually happening. What is really happening is you're just lying in bed, snoring. Like that. And, you know, you'll get up and you'll put your clothes on and you'll actually go to school. So, but we can also do this in daydreaming. You know, sometimes people do that, but they just, especially when I see people in Srimad Bhagavatam class, especially when I'm doing it, and see them sort of wandering off, you know, covering the universe, all the things I'd like to do, and of all the things I could be doing, just sitting here, so, you know, we might daydream, but we create a little separate reality of all the things that the mind would love to have and all the things that the mind wouldn't want to have. So, one who understands that, once we understand, oh, it was just a dream. You know, you wake up and you think, it's just a dream. You know, it wasn't good, it wasn't bad, it's just a dream. It has no, you know, there's nothing to think about. And you just, if it actually happened, of course you'd be thinking about it all the time. If the things that happen in a dream actually happen to you, you know, it'd be completely absorbed. But once you realise, that's just a not even reality, it's just not real. And therefore, I don't even have to think about it at all. I don't have to become fearful or, you know, passive, detached, it's just gone. So material existence, in one sense, is just like that dream state. That we're dreaming, we have a particular body, which is in a certain circumstances, and because of that circumstances we're either very fearful, or very happy, I want more of this, become very greedy, you know, or become very angry. If someone comes up to us and gives us some respect, you're such a wonderful devotee, and you do things so nice, and that. We, you know, we become very happy, I can hear more of that, don't stop there. If someone comes up and to us and says, this right, you haven't done that, you know, what sort of devotee are you, like this. And we immediately become absurd, how dare they, did they not realize it on them, you know, like this. And we become really disturbed. So these things are constantly happening to us in the material world, but when we realize, it's not even real. It's not real. It's not real in the sense that it's not our real existence. It is real in the sense that just as a dream is real. It's not that we didn't have the dream. So it's not like we can't say, well, we're not in the material world. We are in the material world. The material world is a creation of Krishna's energy. So it is real in that sense. And it's real in this sense that if we don't deal with that situation in the material world, we'll have to stay here in this dreamlike existence, birth after birth after birth, and we will suffer. even though that suffering is mental, we'll have to endure that many, many, many births. So, but it's not real in this sense, that it's temporary and illusory, that we are not this body. Who are we? We're actually the spirit soul, and we have a spiritual existence in the spiritual world. Actually, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati before described at the end here. He said, the living entities are fragmental parts of the supreme shelter Krishna, but have fallen from Krishna's kingdom of spiritual pastimes. So there, Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is saying that we've actually fallen from Krishna's kingdom of spiritual pastimes. So we have a personal form, we have a personal relationship with the Supreme Lord, we have particular activities, we have different spiritual emotions. All those things, we have an eternal identity, but at the moment we have no idea who we are. We have forgotten. Just like in the spiritual world, there is Rupa Manjari. And when Rupa Manjari comes to this material world, he becomes Rupa, and she becomes Rupa Goswami. So Rupa Manjari has, that is her eternal name, she has a particular type of colours that she likes to wear, she has a certain circle of inner friends, she has a particular service that she does for Srimati Radharani. She lives in a certain part, you know, relative to, you know, the other gopis and residents. Okay. In this way, there's an eternal identity there. And we have that eternal identity for the place that we, you know, reside, circle of friends, particular type of service, particular type of taste, and what have you. That is it. We have no idea, we've completely forgotten all of that. Because we're dreaming at the moment that, oh, I am this person in the material world. And we become totally absorbed in it. You know that someone is absorbed in the illusion of material existence. That if there's some criticism, then they become angry. If there's some praise, they become elated. You know, what are some of the symptoms described here? Person who is beyond that, they regard happiness and distress alike. They look upon a lump of earth, a stone, a piece of gold, and an evil eye. They're equal toward the desirable and the undesirable. They're steady. Situated equally well in praise and blame, honour and dishonour, who treat alike both friend and enemy. Okay, so in the same way that this is the 14th chapter, text number 22 to 25. This is actually the platform of perfection of sadhana. That when the devotee wakes up, that's actually the way at this stage. And beginning to wake up, Dharma Bhakti before the way. So the Prabhupada says that actually someone asked him, what is the purpose of your movement? He said, the purpose of our Krishna consciousness movement is to wake up the living entities. They're all sleeping. Not only sleeping, in Kali Yuga, the fact that we come to us. Very, very difficult to wake up. And animals, in the human form of life, it's possible to wake someone up to their spiritual existence. In the animal form of life, generally, there is no possibility of waking them up to their spiritual existence. If we bring a whole lot of animals in here, and Srimad Bhagavatam come, you know, at the end of class, they'll still be, you know, doing the same. That's why we're preaching to humans. And at the end of Srimad Bhagavatam class, as humans, we understand, oh, that's right, it's on a spirit soul, I have nothing to do. So, this is the purpose of this Krishna consciousness movement, is to wake up the living entities, particularly human beings, because they're capable of being woken up, unless you're the Lord Himself, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is able to awaken even all living entities as He went through the Charakanda forest, but He certainly cannot imitate the Lord. And the most, Prabhupada says, the most effective way to wake someone up is by sound vibration. He said, if you know, by sight, you cannot do anything. In other words, if you stand there at the end of the bed waving a stick. they won't get up. Even by smell, you know, something most people, when there's fires or different things, it's not enough to actually wake them up. Of course, you can jump on that. I wouldn't recommend it. I'd jump out of bed and jump on it. I remember actually one time, there was one Brahmachari in Adelaide, and he wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. And the temple president sent me in and said, come and get that Brahmachari up. So I stood by the bed and I said, come on, Prabhupada. Hop out of here, everything. Everyone's calling, come on. Someone's in there, go away, go away. So I gave him a little shake and he pounced out of bed, grabbed me in the head like a so we were great. It was lucky. We sort of grabbed both got each other in headlocks and thrown and so we couldn't fight the neck. But you gotta be sort of careful, you know. Physically man can do it. But actually the best way, and of course the most safest way, is by a sound vibration. You can pack someone up, and therefore, you know, we chant Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, and it actually has the effect to waken up the spirit soul. Very, very powerful, extremely powerful, the most powerful medicine, the most powerful method to wake up the living entity when he hears that sound vibration. Because that sound vibration, of course, is coming from the spiritual world. And the soul recognizes it. One time, Srila Prabhupada was giving class, and they used to, in the early days, you know, they used to just drag anyone in off the street, in one sense, just to fill the class a little bit, you know, get some people to hear Srila Prabhupada. And some of them were, you know, just intoxicated, some of them were drunk, some of them were, you know, coming down from, you know, some, you know, whatever they were on, they would just sort of sit there, like this. And one devotee asked Prabhupada, is there any real benefits in these people sitting here? They don't hear a word, you see. And Srila Prabhupada said that the soul hears. He said the soul hears. And it has an effect. Because the sound vibration is transcendental, it's actually important in the spiritual world. And the soul, even though the material body may not be conscious, the soul recognizes that is what I'm searching for. Even deep. So it's very, very powerful. In the same way, it's the medicine. If you give someone medicine, whether they're and the medicine is what they need, whether they're awake or asleep, doesn't really affect the potency of the medicine. If that's the proper medicine, it doesn't really matter. Of course, when a person is awake, they can do all the things required to give that medicine the maximum potency. There are, you know, through their diet and through, you know, what have you. So when a person is awake, takes the medicine and can follow all the other prescriptions of the doctor, of course, they get the best effect. that even if a person is asleep, still that medicine will act, it will gradually bring them to consciousness, and then they can follow gradually all the other prescriptions of the doctor, so then they will also get the full benefits. So I think that's the purpose of our Krishna consciousness movement, is to wake people up. But we can't wake others up if we're asleep ourselves. If we're still thinking that we're these material bodies and absorbed in everything that happens to the material body, the duality of life, that, you know, that symptom that we're practicing devotional service, and we still have to come to that perfection of sadhana. This is the perfection of sadhana, when actually the bodily concept of life is actually not there. And you see that whatever is happening in the material world, that is just material energy in its three modes, even this material body, whatever is happening to the material body, it is simply the interaction of modes of material nature, and the devotee who is perfected their sadhana, if they're doing devotional service properly, they'll actually become completely aloof to devotional service, to the material body. And there's an example here in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the 13th chapter of this 11th canto, where one of the, I forget who it was, maybe, I'm not sure who it is, he says that the devotee physician is like a drunk person, that a person who is intoxicated, they don't know, you know, whether they've got their shirt on, or their jacket, or whether they left it behind. In one sense, they're oblivious. So, in a material sense, so we can understand, you know, from an intoxicated person, they're sort of oblivious to what's happened. It's a very bad thing. In the material world, it's a bad thing. Very bad thing. Just like a couple of nights ago, there was a young Indian boy up, I'm not sure if it was in Melbourne, Queensland, probably in Melbourne. He just got his learner's plate, intoxicated, speeding, tearing through the city, and lost control of the car. The car spun out and hit two other students who just happened to walk out of the building, killed one of them, the other one is still fighting for his life. So in the material world, that sort of intoxication is a very, very, you know, not a very nice thing. But spiritually, sense is there that one is so intoxicated with the devotional service and the transcendental qualities of the Supreme Lord and the transcendental reciprocation from the Supreme Lord, that so absorbed in that, that they're just oblivious, become oblivious to material life. So much so that the pure devotees, you know, whether they're sitting or standing, sometimes they, you know, they're not considering, you know, what is happening is so absorbed in Krishna consciousness. Srila Prabhupada explains that actually a pure devotee, apart from their understanding that is Krishna pleased, is Krishna happy, they have no real sense of their own pleasure or happiness. But they, you know, you ask a pure devotee, you know, are you happy, you know, unhappy? In one sense, the question doesn't quite compute because they're so detached from the bodily concept of life. They're only aware of Krishna's happiness. Their own personal, so very, very elevated, very, very elevated, because we can't imitate that. But still, we should all be trying to perform our devotional service in such a way that we are coming towards this point of devotional service where we are becoming completely aloof from the material bodily concept of life. So just leave that there. If anyone has any questions or comments,
I used to have a dream where I discovered that all I was wearing was my singlet. So the rest of the drink from a form of singular thing around the beach. So it's no one can sit there and have a choice on that.
The Louis song, no.
I wonder what that is.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe it's yoga. Not one of the yogis in previous life. Maybe. Yoga bubble or something. Still climbing down to the west.
You mentioned that the devotee has some, you know, at Ruchi they're attached to doing their service.
That is.
Expecting their service.
Yeah, they're also attached to Krishna, of course, but their absorption in their service is predominant. Yeah.
Of course, a person can be absorbed in their service simply because that's just their natural proclivity, you know what I mean? And you know, trying to artificially, you know, just be detached from doing whatever comes because that's devotional service is also a very elevated platform. So I guess my point would be that, you know, those levels of devotional service are actually very, very high, highly advanced for the rank and file, not the imitator.
No, that's right, yes. Because at the stage of unsteady devotional service, which a lot of devotees are on, is one of the things that they call it, I think it's a Sanskrit name, but it sort of means absorption in the facilities of one's devotional service. So, sometimes devotees are really attached to a particular sort of service at that unsteady state of devotional service because there's some facilities that they're really enjoying from it.
Yeah.
So there's a difference there between that devotee who's attached to the facilities of the devotional service, and then when the facilities are not there, their service wavers, of course. So that's the platform of unsteady devotional service, which is not to be confused with the devotee who's actually attached to the service at Ruchi. And at Ruchi they're really at the point where it is you know, they're attached to serving Krishna for Krishna's pleasure, and not so much the facilities, and they're trying to perfect that service, you know, in doing it very nice, knowing that it pleases Krishna, and not so much absorbed in the facility that comes with it. So
if they're successful or unsuccessful, or whether the facility is there or not, they'll keep engaged in
it. They keep doing it. They keep perfecting. They love perfecting that service. And whether the facility is there or no facility, they just love that. You know, whether they're getting praised or blamed or what have you, they're still, you know, they just love doing that service. That's not to be confused with that unsteady platform. It's a very elevated thing.
Of course, just on the point of no clothes, the Navayogendras are also transcendentalists.
Right.
And it's described earlier on that they're actually at the same level as the four Kumaras. They're also, and you know, sometimes when you see the Nagababas at the Kumbhamela, and you see these fellows with the dreadlocks and whatever, and they're walking around with no clothes on, you sort of think, what's going on here? But when you think about it, actually there is a tradition of transcendentalists so absorbed in devotional service that the externals are not important to them. And also Sukadeva Goswami, for that. They're so elevated, and of course the the person who, he's not wearing any clothes. So, and the persons who are associated with them are so exalted that they recognise the transcendental characteristics of such persons, and you know, it's acceptable.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
I mean, it's just a comment. It occurred to me when I was reading about the Navayogendras that actually they were, you know, they travelled and they were naked.
Right, they were naked as well.
Okay. Yeah, and you know, Obviously, that Prabhupada had the American with my clothes on. It would have been very welcome.
Yes, but it doesn't mean he's not on that platform. He comes.
That's right.
He comes down to the Ujjama Adhikari comes down to the platform of the Madhyama Adhikari in order to preach. Otherwise, people could not understand their level, their imitated level.
And you know, the funny thing is that Prabhupada would, not funny thing, but you know, sometimes Prabhupada would get upset and disturbed about whether he was being successful or not. You know, there was a time when Tamal Krishna was telling a story where Prabhupada, you know, was chanting in his lounge and then he just put his mouth, put his feet back and said, I can't chant. Catch up around. Because he was too upset about what was going on in Mumbai.
They're changed in mental emotions, right?
Not material.
They're not based upon attachment to the dream of material existence. They're transcendental emotions because he's absorbed in the reality of his relationship with Krishna.
Well, he wanted to offer Radha Rasa Bihari a nice temple.
Yeah.
And he made that promise to Krishna that he would do that. And when he was getting, you know, there were obstacles for him.
There's actually, in the purport here, and also in the Bhagavad Gita, it says the same thing, that actually, unless one comes to a platform of pure devotional service, free from karma, jnana, one cannot actually not manifest properly, fully, these symptoms described here. And when you mention the Naga Babas, it's interesting because they appear to be completely detached from all worldly dualities, but when they have the Kumbh Mela, they've got to be first. They've got to have that respect in this material world. And if they're not first, they become very, very angry. They fight like cats and dogs. And sometimes people get killed. You see, although certainly very elevated, but without devotional service, even great yogis like that cannot actually artificially imitate fully. You know, there's some degree there, there's some degree of detachment, but to be fully situated and never actually go back to that material attachment, one has to be situated in devotional service. Then one can manifest the transcendental quality such as the Shiva Prabhupada.
When the Buddha Master comes into the dream, I'm not only just about dreaming or the Buddha Master, is it the Buddha Master and the dream, is it like a conscious decision often, or how does it work? So like, the Buddha Master decides to enter into the dream, or like,
Well, the Supreme Lord empowers the Spiritual Master to deliver his disciples.
My favourite story about dreams and the Spiritual Master, I had a dream once that my Spiritual Master told me to go and preach in Bali. That was a very clear and distinct dream. It wasn't a fuzzy, wuzzy dream or anything. And I sort of thought, well, maybe that's what I should do. And I thought, I never had a dream again. When I met my Spiritual Master next time, he didn't mention it, did he? So I figured, well, it was just a dream.
Did you bring it up to him?
No.
No, he never mentioned it.
It was important. It was important enough for him to tell me that I should be, if he said to me, I thought you'd go to Bali, I'd be brilliant. I kind of, it was an important instruction. But he didn't do that, so I figured that was just a dream.
But, So it's significant that when a devotee is dreaming, they're still meditating upon reality. It's still a dreaming state, so we don't take everything, that's the absolute truth. but they're still meditating upon the relationship with the Guru, they're meditating upon the relationship with Krishna, and in this way their dreams actually become transcendental.
Yeah.
Yeah. The questions are coming? So I'll go to the